Welcome to HN Pod, the daily show where we dive into the top stories, trends, and discussions from Hacker News. I am Sarah.
And I am Mike. Thanks for joining us for episode 434. Today, we are looking back at the biggest stories from yesterday, June 21, 2026. We have a really fascinating mix of topics today. We are going to talk about the geopolitical fallout of Anthropic's new identity verification rules, a massive open-source real-time strategy game, a 10-year-old programming philosophy that is still causing debates, the psychology of why our brains are melting from too much bad news, and finally, a massive milestone for the internet as IPv6 hits 50% adoption.
Let us dive right into the top story. Anthropic just announced they are rolling out identity verification on Claude. They are partnering with a company called Persona to require a valid government-issued photo ID and a live selfie for certain use cases. They say this is for platform integrity, safety, and compliance, and they promise they are not using the data to train models. But Mike, the Hacker News comment section on this one was incredibly intense, and it really highlighted where we are at with AI in 2026.
Absolutely. The technical side of handing over your passport to use an API is annoying enough, but the real story in the comments is about global politics and supply chain risk. There was a massive comment from a user named Data Ottawa that really set the tone. They pointed out that as a non-US citizen, the recent US export restrictions on large language models have completely changed the landscape. They mentioned that Opus 4.8 is basically the best American model they will ever have access to, and paying Anthropic feels like paying for a depreciating asset because they're locked out of the newer restricted models like Fable.
Right, and requiring an American identity verification partner like Persona on top of that just feels like a massive wall going up. We are really seeing AI models being treated as critical national security infrastructure now, almost like cryptography was in the 1990s during the crypto wars. Another commenter pointed that out, reminding everyone how the US government used to force software makers to maintain weakened international editions of their encryption software.
Exactly. And because of this friction, you're seeing developers actively looking to de-risk their businesses. If your entire startup relies on an Anthropic or OpenAI model, and you wake up one day to find your account banned because of a mismatched ID or a new export control, your business is dead overnight. People in the comments are talking about migrating their workflows to European models like Mistral Vibe. Even if the open-weight models occasionally write incorrect tool calls or struggle with ambiguity compared to Opus, the fact that you can actually control them and not worry about a sudden geopolitical ban makes them incredibly attractive.
It's a classic case of strict regulation creating a massive market opportunity for international competitors. When developers feel like second-class citizens on a platform, they will endure a lot of technical friction to move to a platform where they feel safe. It will be really interesting to see if Anthropic and OpenAI start feeling the financial pinch from alienating the global developer community, especially with the massive data center debts they're carrying right now.
Speaking of communities, our next story is about a much more fun topic, but with its own share of drama. It's about a game called Beyond All Reason, or BAR. It's a completely free open-source real-time strategy game inspired by the classic Total Annihilation. And when I say massive scale, I mean it. We are talking about fully simulated projectile ballistics, terrain deformation, and thousands of units on screen at once.
The technical achievement here is just staggering. To have a community-driven, open-source game that looks and plays better than a lot of AAA studio releases is amazing. But while the post got a lot of love for the game itself, the top comments immediately pivoted to a very familiar problem in competitive online gaming: the toxicity of the community.
Yeah, a user named Etherspawn wrote a really thoughtful critique. They played the game for a year, but ended up quitting because the public lobbies are incredibly rigid. If you do not follow the exact meta build order of the month, your own team will gang up on you, vote to kick you, and take control of your units. There is also this bizarre unwritten rule where if the front line breaks, you are expected to immediately surrender rather than letting the backline players try to recover and play the game out.
Which totally defeats the purpose of playing a massive war simulator. Half the fun of those games is the desperate last stand. But what I loved about this Hacker News thread is that the community manager for the game, who goes by PTAC, actually jumped into the comments to address it. They apologized, encouraged people to report harassment, and suggested playing in what they call rotato lobbies, which rotate maps and tend to have players who are way more relaxed about roles and strategies.
It is a great response, but Etherspawn pushed back, noting that they had actually submitted a pull request to the community code of conduct to protect players who just want to play the game out naturally, and the developers rejected it in favor of the hyper-competitive players.
It is a fascinating microcosm of online communities. When a game gets popular, the hardcore players optimize the fun out of it. They want the tightest loop possible to winning and restarting, and anyone who gets in the way of that efficiency becomes a target.
It really makes you appreciate the value of private servers and just playing with a close group of friends. All right, let us shift gears from gaming architecture to software architecture. Our third story is a blast from the past that hit the front page again. It's Sandy Metz's famous 2016 blog post titled, "Prefer Duplication Over the Wrong Abstraction."
Oh man, this is one of those timeless pieces of programming wisdom. Every few years it makes the rounds on Hacker News, and every time a new generation of developers has their mind blown. The core premise is something we have all experienced. Programmer A sees two pieces of code that look similar, extracts them into a shared function, and feels great about themselves. Then programmer B comes along with a new requirement that only applies to one case. Because of the sunk cost fallacy, instead of undoing the abstraction, they add a parameter and an if statement. Fast forward a few years and you have a monster function with 10 Boolean flags that nobody understands and everyone is terrified to touch.
The wrong abstraction, it is so painful. Sandy argues that when you find yourself in this situation, the fastest way forward is actually backwards. You have to inline the code, reintroduce the duplication, and let the code breathe so you can see what the actual pattern is supposed to be. Duplication is far cheaper than the wrong abstraction.
The comments on this were basically a group therapy session for developers. A user named Jonah X made a brilliant point about locality. When you make a change to a code base, the only property you really care about is locality. You want to make a change over here and not worry about accidentally breaking something completely unrelated over there. Premature abstraction destroys locality.
There was a little bit of pushback, of course. Some people brought up the single source of truth principle, arguing that if you duplicate code and then a bug is found, you might fix it in one place and forget to fix it in the other. But the consensus seemed to be that accidental divergence is still usually easier to untangle than intentional, highly coupled spaghetti code. It is a great reminder that the DRY principle, do not repeat yourself, is a guideline, not a religion. Sometimes repeating yourself is exactly what the code base needs.
Absolutely. Okay, moving on to our fourth story. And this one hits a little close to home for anyone who spends too much time on Hacker News or social media. The article is from Science Daily, titled, "Your Brain Was Never Designed for This Much Bad News."
This was a really sobering read. The premise is based on evolutionary biology. Our brains are hardwired with a negativity bias. Thousands of years ago, if you ignored a beautiful sunset, nothing happened. If you ignored a rustle in the grass, you got eaten by a predator. So we evolved to pay hyper attention to threats. The problem is that our brains have not changed, but the environment has. We are now scanning the entire globe for threats 24/7.
Right. Before smartphones, your threats were local. A bad storm, a sick neighbor. Now, before you even have your morning coffee, your brain is trying to process a war on one continent, a financial crisis on another, and a climate disaster somewhere else. The article points out that this is leading to what psychologists are now calling problematic news consumption, or PNC. In severe cases, it completely disrupts daily functioning. And globally, 40% of people say they are actively avoiding the news now because it just makes them feel overwhelmed and powerless.
The feeling of powerlessness is the key there. The research shows that the gap between awareness and agency is one of the strongest predictors of psychological distress. If you read about a local issue, you can maybe go to a town hall or volunteer. If you read about a macroeconomic crisis across the world, you just sit there and absorb the cortisol.
And the algorithms know this. The article referenced a study of over 100,000 news headlines showing that every single additional negative word increased the click-through rate. We are literally fighting against supercomputers designed to exploit our ancient survival instincts. But the researchers say the answer is not to just put your head in the sand. A functioning democracy needs informed citizens.
Exactly. They suggest managing your information diet, setting defined windows of time for news, choosing long-form, carefully reported articles over endless social media feeds, and learning to recognize rage bait. It is about cognitive distance. When you see a post and realize the creator is just trying to provoke you for engagement, it breaks the spell a little bit. I think that is something the HackerUse community generally tries to do, focusing on deep technical reads rather than outrage, but we are all susceptible to the doom scroll.
So true. I have definitely had to put op timers on my phone just to break the habit. All right, let's wrap up today with some good news, or at least a major technical milestone.
Our final story is from the APNIC blog, announcing that Google's measurements show global IPv6 adoption has finally hit 50%.
50%? It only took, what, 25 years?
Something like that. The article does a great job breaking down the data. It notes that while Google sees 50%, APNIC's own measurements show about 42%. The discrepancy comes down to how they sample. APNIC uses ad placements and weights the data based on a country's estimated internet population, whereas Google is just looking at raw traffic to their services. But either way, it is a huge moment.
It is, but the Hacker News comments quickly turned into a venting session about internet service providers. A user named JDBP brought the receipts, linking to a press release from Virgin Media in the UK. Back in 2011, on World IPv6 Day, Virgin Media publicly stated they were rigorously testing their network and would fully support IPv6 by the end of 2012. Here we are in 2026, 15 years later, and they still have not flicked the switch.
That is hilarious and tragic. And it sparked a massive debate about telecom monopolies, especially in the US. Someone suggested that websites should put up big red warning banners if a user connects via IPv4 to shame the ISPs. But as an American user pointed out, most people in the US only have one wireline broadband provider anyway. You can't exactly vote with your wallet if your only choice is a single local cable monopoly.
Contrast that with the comments from users in Australia and parts of the EU, where the physical fiber infrastructure is decoupled from the service providers. In Australia, the government laid the fiber, and you can choose from nearly 100 different ISPs. If one does not support IPv6, you just switch to one that does, and it takes 10 minutes. It really shows that the bottleneck for IPv6 at this point is not the technology, it's just business incentives and lack of market competition.
Exactly. For new networks like Reliance Jio in India or the big mobile carriers, deploying IPv6 from day one makes total financial sense. But for legacy cable companies sitting on a massive hoard of IPv4 addresses, they have zero incentive to spend the capital to upgrade unless their customers can actually leave them. But still, crossing the halfway mark globally is worth celebrating. The two-protocol world is messy, but we're slowly dragging the internet into the future.
Slowly but surely. And that's a wrap for today's episode of HN Pod. From AI geopolitics and toxic gamers to coding philosophies, brain science, and the never-ending saga of IPv6, it was a packed day on the Orange site.
Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoy the show, please share it with your team or leave us a review. We will be back tomorrow to break down the next batch of top stories. Until then, keep building, keep learning, and maybe turn off the news for a few hours today. Catch you next time.